Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, our guest says we can do a lot to prevent sexual assault by focusing on preventing men from becoming perpetrators in the first place. We'll hear about his work on ending gender violence on college campuses and elsewhere. First, in a world where nearly anything can be bought on the internet at the click of a button and delivered in a day or two, the choice to make something by hand can really stand out. The need to make things like our own clothing, tools, and kitchenware for our survival has disappeared, but for many people, making things with their hands brings them fulfillment and joy that buying stuff just doesn't. It can be anything from building a kitchen cabinet, knitting a scarf, dyeing cloth, sewing clothes, lots of possibilities. Our next guest has been a maker for a long time and wanted to find out more about why making things still has value in our fast-changing world. Melanie Falick is an independent writer, editor, creative consultant, and lifelong maker. She's the former publishing director of STC Craft Melanie Falick Books, an imprint of Abrams, and the former editor-in-chief of Interweave Knits magazine. She's the author of several books on knitting, and her latest book is called Making a Life: Working by Hand and Discovering the Life You Are Meant to Live. Melanie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
At the personal level, when did you first realize that there was something special about the way you felt when you were working with your hands?
Well, I grew up in a family where everybody worked with their hands, just sometimes because we needed something, sometimes because we just wanted to do something. So it was really normal. I think what really struck me in my 20s was when I became an avid knitter and I realized that not everybody was into it, that people actually thought it was a strange thing to do. And then I started to realize that things that I took for granted in my family were, you know, my mother sewed clothing. I kind of knew how to sew. I knew how to knit. You know, my father did pottery and jewelry making because they wanted to, that was unusual. I think a lot of times as you grow up and get out in the world, you find out, you know, that what happened in your family wasn't happening everywhere. So I think that was really surprising to me. And when I became a knitter and was so excited about it, I felt a little bit sorry for people who hadn't discovered it.
Well, you met in the course of researching this book a lot of people who are doing really cool stuff. We're going to meet some of them in just a bit. But I want to tackle a couple core questions that guided you, I think, through a lot of these conversations. Question one, at a really basic level, why do we want to make things with our hands? Coming out of talking with all these people, what kind of answers did you start to see to that question?
I actually think it's our evolutionary birthright. I think it's a natural instinct that our society or our culture sometimes tries to push out of us. You know, it tells us that, oh, you should consume things, or you should do things. Things have value if they make you money or if they go really quickly. And I think as a counterbalance to that, there are people who, many of us, who feel this instinctual desire to slow down, to use our hands to make things, to use our hands to make the ordinary extraordinary. It's really a natural instinct. And I believe that we all have an instinct for creative expression very often with our hands, but we kind of get distracted by some other things that our culture tells us we should be focusing on.
One thing you talk about and others in your book talk about, and I've heard people say this, something along the lines of, when I'm working with my hands, I feel calm, or it feels therapeutic. Talk about that feeling.
Yeah, I think when I'm working with my hands, I feel grounded. I feel focused. It's a chance to relax and recalibrate. And this is when we look at evolution, making by hand used to be part of survival. You couldn't survive if you couldn't make with your hands. You needed to make tools. You needed to make shelter. You needed to make clothing. Now, at least, you know, in many places in the world, not every single one, perhaps, making by hand is not necessary for that level of physical survival. But the process of making by hand is something that is quite nourishing. I don't know a lot of makers who are doing it because they just want the finished product. They're doing it because they want the process. They want the, you know, the grounding, the joy, the fulfillment that comes from that process. And people sometimes will say, I hand sew some of my clothing, and they say, oh my gosh, like, that must take so long. Like, what do you like about this? And I say, that's exactly what I like about it. It's really, really slow. I also like, and I think a lot of makers do, I mean, certainly all the people in my book, it's taking agency over your own life. You know, just because I can, with the click of a button, order something, you know, online, or doesn't mean that I want to. Sometimes doing the work to get something makes it more, makes you more grateful and more appreciative in the long run. So as I said before, just because something is quick or inexpensive or easy doesn't make it valuable.
We're talking to Melanie Falick about her new book. It's called Making a Life, Working by Hand and Discovering the Life You Are Meant to Live. You can join in, by the way, at 800-642-1234. Do you make something by hand? How does it feel when you're doing it? Why do you like doing it? Or did you used to and got out of it? Or do you want to but don't know how to get into it? Call 800-642-1234. Melanie, that first question you tackle, why do we want to make things with our hands? Then the next question, why do we want to make them beautiful? There's something about not just the thing, but making it special in some way. Can you talk about that part of the story?
Yeah, again, I think it's just a natural human instinct. And my book begins with a Q&A with Ellen Dasaniaki, who's a scholar who has spent the last 50 years researching and thinking about just this subject. And she finds in her research that you can go back like hundreds of thousands of years, and there is evidence of making special. But when we make things special, we give them more meaning. So for example, you could make a pot, let's say you needed a vessel to hold something. There is an instinct to put stripes on it or flowers on it. By the same token, it's not always just making things. It could be, you know, getting dressed up in a special way for an occasion, whether, you know, you see it a lot in religious occasions where people wear something particular or set the table in a certain way. By doing that, they actually bring meaning and importance to it. So I think that, you know, if you analyze a lot of the things that you do, you see that you do choose to make the ordinary extraordinary to show to yourself that these things matter to you.
When I think of people doing crafts, I think of it as a solitary thing, but you've got a whole section in your book on people doing it as a communal activity, including a quilt guild, an African-American quilt guild in Oakland. Can you talk about them and how they do this together and work to pass it along to another generation?
Yeah, I think that, I during the research for the book, I spent a day with the African American Quilt Guild of Oakland in one of the members' houses. And they are a special group because they're special people. And they spend a lot of time getting together and quilting together and educating the community and making quilts for good causes and being involved in art exhibitions. But I think that what they're doing speaks to something that is very broadly popular in this country and in many places abroad, which is that people want to have a reason to come together in community. And oftentimes, it's hard. Let's say you go to a cocktail party. You have kind of sometimes like awkward conversations, small talk. But imagine if you were all shared something, like you all enjoyed quilting and you had your handwork with you. Immediately, some of the social kind of nervousness fades away because you can talk to the people about what you love because you've met on those in that area of commonality. So I think that happens all over the place. And these days there are lots of knitting guilds and knitting groups and people go to shared pottery studios. And I often think when I don't actually drink coffee, but sometimes I'll go into like a local coffee shop and you see all these people sitting there at their computers, and they're not necessarily interacting a lot, but they want to be social. And I think, again, that goes back to within our evolution, being social, depending on one another, being interconnected. That was and is still, I think, a way to survive. And the internet and our screens and all the things, you know, we think that, well, let me just back up for a second. These things can bring us together. The internet can help us to meet each other, but that doesn't replace the in-person connection, which we long for. And when we are makers and we can find other people in our community, or we can find them when we're traveling, it enriches our experiences.
Melanie Falick is with us. Her new book is called Making a Life, Working by Hand and Discovering the Life You Are Meant to Live. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you are a maker of things, tell us about it. Is it a hobby for you, a job, a little of both? Why is making things by hand important to you? How do you feel when you're actually doing it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up the conversation with Melanie Falick. Her new book is called Making a Life, Working by Hand and Discovering the Life You Are Meant to Live. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you enjoy working with your hands, whether it's woodworking, fiber arts, sewing, painting, cooking, metalworking, you name it? We want to hear your experiences, what keeps you coming back to it. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to our callers now. We've got Nancy on the line in Milwaukee. Nancy, hello.
Hello. I wanted to tell you that I've always been very interested in refinishing furniture. And I found that when I buy or somebody gives me a cast-off piece of furniture, to strip away whatever layers of paint or varnish have been put on that and then to refinish it, it's really a very emotionally gratifying experience, because you now have justified, again, the cutting down of the wood tree that piece of furniture was made from originally. And now that I've given it a new life, it could go on to a new person, and hopefully that person would cherish it, and maybe in the future someone else would buy it and refinish it once more. It is just very gratifying. And I also like to weave ribbons into fabric, and then I use that fabric to make beautiful throws for the sofa or pillows. I like to paint and sew.
Wow.
I think life is full of possibilities that when you're done with the end of your work day, I always worked in hospital laboratories, and when you're, you know, which are filled with sterile things and steel and chromium, and when I was done with that, to go home and work with my hands, it is just wonderful.
Nancy, thank you so much for calling. Melanie, sounds like she's right in touch with the spirit of your book.
Absolutely. I love everything Nancy had to say. I feel like I could sort of go on and on with all those themes. I mean, the fulfillment you get from creativity and competence, and in addition to that, these days, and doing something to help to protect the environment from all sorts of degradation. I mean, it feels great. I think most makers are surprised that there are so many people who sort of marginalize it, because it's fulfilling in so many different ways, as Nancy explained for her experience.
Nancy, thank you so much for sharing that with us. We'll go to Harry now in Rock Falls. Harry, hello.
Hi. Hey. So I am in a jug band, and jug bands are known for making their own instruments. You know, you got the washtub bass and the washboard and stuff. So I make ukuleles out of gourds, and I'm actually working at, Rob, this is for you. Working on a saxophone.
No way.
Yeah, I'm working on a saxophone out of a gourd, but I haven't quite got the double curve in yet. But so I'm working on it. So when I get it, I'll send it to you. So,
Harry, thank you so much. That's great. I play saxophone. Melanie is what he was referring to there. I'd love to try that gourd saxophone. That's a unique thing I've never heard of, Melanie. And a lot of the people you talk to, you just met so many people who did such a wide variety of different kinds of things. The list is almost endless, isn't it?
It really is. And remember that it used to be that just about everything that you wanted that didn't occur in nature was made by hand. You know, it's fascinating. Where I live, there's a man who makes string instruments, and you know, you look at them and you think, oh my gosh, it doesn't even occur to you how it's made until you meet somebody who actually does it and can see what they do or talk to them about what they do. And you know, I would love to see those ukuleles and saxophones. when I was working on the book, I had an experience where I was meeting with shoemakers, and I realized, you know, even being so focused on making by hand, that I had kind of just taken it for granted, like how shoes were made. And, you know, once you have the opportunity to learn some techniques about how you make something, you really appreciate what others do for you and what machines do for you. And you can make educated decisions about what you want to make yourself or consume. So it really enriches your experience in a lot of different ways.
Thanks a lot for the call, Harry. We are talking to Melanie Falik, author of the new book, Making a Life, Working by Hand and Discovering the Life You Are Meant to Live. Back to your calls now. Mary is with us in Greendale. Mary, hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. One of the things that I'm really interested in is the makers movement. And a lot of people that I talk to really don't even know what that is about. Here in Milwaukee, they have a big warehouse. They oftentimes have conferences over, I think it was actually downtown this last year. And it's just a big trend towards getting back to using your hands. And what I'm very interested in is how crafting and making things by hand and doing all of those things do equate to child development. My kids all started pretty much crafting as soon as they were able to pick up a pencil or a crayon. And whether it's painting rocks or, you know, knitting or weaving or whatever it was they were interested in, I think it's so important that kids go out and use their imagination. And even if they can do it outside, I personally go to an art group every week. There's some lovely ladies that all meet once a week. It's as social of a time as it is an art time. We have a fantastic teacher who is actually an art therapist, retired, and it is fantastic.
Mary, thank you so much. You've given us so much to work with there. Melanie, let's start with the kids and the idea of getting kids involved in making in whatever form.
Yeah, I agree with Mary. It's a making by hand, being creative. That's a very important part of child development. And it's interesting because we really encourage our kids to make things with their hands up to a certain point. You know, we encourage them to finger paint. We encourage them to make clay bookends. We encourage them to make costumes and sing and dance. And then at a certain point in our educational system, we kind of start to halt it and say, oh, these other things are more important, these more serious subjects. And it has never made sense to me. I think that when you are learning to do things on your own, with your own hands, you are stretching your imagination. You're learning about problem solving. You're learning all sorts of skills that are important for your development. And this kind of going back to what Mary said about the maker movement, and some people define that in a way that is also brings in technology and the idea of kind of making things that involve technology. And I think it's all related. I'm not saying like, oh, we should push aside technology. But, you know, when kids are learning how to, you know, like make machines or make computer programs, but they're not just using a screen and pressing buttons, but they're using like hands-on activities and experience and feeling things and hearing things and using all of their senses, then they are developing important skills and also developing competence and confidence. And all of that can be applied in all aspects of their lives in a positive way.
Mary, thanks a lot for the call. Melanie, in our last couple of minutes, I want to talk about inspiration for those of us who don't make. You mentioned the shoemakers group, and you shared the story in your book of the woman who started it, who said to, I think, her boyfriend in her 20s, you know, when I retire, I want to learn to make shoes. And her boyfriend said, well, why wait 40, 50 years? Why not do it now? For those people thinking, yeah, maybe someday, can you give us some encouragement on how to make someday today?
Yeah. I always encourage people to just sit down and make a list of all the things that the whispers in their head say that they want to do. Like, do you want to learn how to make pickles? Or do you want to learn how to do watercolors? Or do you want to just spend more time doing pottery and you already know how to do it? But listen to what the voice inside of you has said and write it down. Write it down on a piece of paper with a pen or a pencil and look at your book. Or look at your, not your book, look at what you've written down, look at your paper. And then when you're faced with certain decisions about what you're going to do with your time, maybe just in the nooks and crannies of your life, maybe you'll sort of go to the knitting group meeting down the street from you instead of watching Netflix, or instead of starting to go through your Instagram feed. Or maybe you'll just doodle on a piece of paper, or maybe you'll put your watercolors on your desk so that when you need a break, instead of, you know, going surfing the internet, you might just get your brush and do watercolors for 5 minutes. I think, though, we often say, oh, I don't have time for that. But I think a lot of times it has to do with priorities. And we can, even if it has to be just in a small way, incorporate these things that we feel in our bones we want to do. And then bit by bit, we might be able to have that grow and have it and be able to find more time for it.
Fantastic advice, Melanie. Thanks for joining us and thanks for the inspiration.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
That's Melanie Fallick. Her latest book is called Making a Life, Working by Hand and Discovering the Life You Are Meant to Live. You can still share your stories of making things by hand over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up, a world-renowned educator and author on gender, race, and violence is coming to UW-Eau Claire tonight to talk about putting an end to gender violence. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret, hosting today from our studio in Wausau. Coming up, President Trump and congressional leaders are discussing an economic stimulus package for workers and businesses hurt by COVID-19. We'll talk about policy responses to the spread of the virus and the economic damage it's causing. Now, Hollywood mogul and convicted rapist Harvey Weinstein is scheduled to be sentenced in a New York courtroom tomorrow. He faces 5 to 25 years in prison after being found guilty of sexually assaulting a production assistant and raping an aspiring actress. He was acquitted of other charges. The accusations against Weinstein put the Me Too movement in the public eye, shining a light on gender relations at the workplace, the dating scene, and college campuses. According to a 2016 federal government report, 1 in 4 female undergraduates will be sexually assaulted before they graduate, and the American Civil Liberties Union estimates that 95% of campus rapes go unreported. Our next guest says we need to change the way we educate and talk about sexual assault on and off campuses. Jackson Katz is an educator, author, and social theorist who focuses on gender, race, and violence. He's written 2 books, The Macho Paradox, Why Some Men Hurt Women, and How All Men Can Help, and Man Enough, Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton, and the Politics of Presidential Masculinity. He'll be talking about gender violence at UW-Eau Claire this evening. He talked to Judith Sears Poisson earlier today.
Jackson, you had a quote on social media that garnered a lot of attention. You said, "We talk about how many women were raped last year, not about how many men raped women." Why does the conversation need to go there?
Well, the way that we use language is the way that we think and the way that we understand the world. And a big part of my both scholarship and activist educator work over the past generation, really, it's been a while, it's been several decades. A big part of my work has been to try to help people shift the paradigm and shift the conceptual framework that they bring to this, the discussions about sexual assault and domestic violence and sexual harassment. A lot of people still think those issues are women's issues that some good men help out with. And my argument is that these are really men's issues. I'm sorry, but men are committing the vast majority of sexual harassment, domestic violence, sexual assault. And yet the language that we use to talk about those subjects omits men and deletes men. So you'll hear people using passive language, how many women were raped, rather than how many men raped women. Even the term violence against women is problematic because it's passive. There's nobody doing it to them. Women are experiencing it, but nobody's doing it to them. So if you insert the active agent in linguistic terms, men, you have a new phrase, men's violence against women. It doesn't roll off the tongue as easily, but it's more accurate and it's more honest. And by the way, can I also say, this is not anti-male in any way. I don't think that part of the problem and part of the reason why even women in the domestic and sexual violence field use sometimes gender neutral language and passive voice is because they're worried about getting pushback from men and sometimes hostility from men who are offended by the implication that they're somehow part of the problem. And as a result, we have this real stasis and real lack of forward movement. If men will say it, it'll take some of the pressure off of those women who are worried about getting that kind of pushback. So I always appeal to men, not just boys and young men in college and young populations, but adult men in positions of institutional power and cultural authority. And if more adult men will start saying, look, this is about men. We as men need to own this stuff. We need to stand with women as our partners and allies. If more men would say that and we use the active language, then it would open up space, I think. And we have a chance at really seriously addressing these problems in a way going forward.
You mentioned several different arenas there where men are able to stand up and say, this is not okay, this is not how we should be acting. You are going to be speaking at UW-Eau Claire this evening. You spend a lot of time on college campuses with that population. Why do you think there is such an issue of sexual violence on college campuses?
Well, we have a big problem of sexual violence in our society and in the world. College populations, the typical traditional age of college populations is right in the center of the highest level of perpetration, like the 18 to 24 year old age group. You have lots of young people coming together in social and other confined spaces. And you have lots of alcohol. You have, you know, the sexual culture, if you will, is you know, right in front of you and in a college population. So, I mean, it's similar to militaries in the sense of the age group. The predominant age group is young, late adolescence, early adulthood. I think for all those structural reasons, that's what we're talking about. It's not something specific to a specific campus. But clearly, sexual assault has been a big problem on college campuses for decades. This is not a recent problem. It was a problem when I was in college. I mean, we've made a lot of progress as a in the field or as a movement against sexual violence. We've made a lot of progress in identifying the problem. I don't think we've made as much progress in providing services for victims and survivors and support for victims and survivors. It's not perfect by any stretch, but we've made a lot of progress since the 70s. But I think we still have a persistent problem, in part because we have this larger cultural problem that persists.
Have you seen any colleges do a really good job of, as you said, providing not just services for survivors, but prevention and really holding perpetrators accountable?
Yes and no. I mean, I wouldn't want to name any specific colleges or universities. I would say that in my extensive work across the country on college and university campuses, there's what the status quo is hardly adequate, and especially in the prevention side of the house, which is what I do mostly. Yes, there are different programs, there are different schools that have great violence prevention coordinators and Title IX offices. Although the Title IX world is having to work with the pullback by the federal government, by the Trump administration in terms of Title IX enforcement. So there's these big political questions that have to be addressed and how that plays out on college campuses. But I have to say, I think that colleges and universities could be doing way more than they're doing in a general sense in terms of prevention. But it costs money. It takes time. It takes I mean, people's time. It takes institutional commitment and follow through. A lot of this takes both thoughtful, you know, examination and research, but also I think we have enough research. To be honest with you, I think we need more committed leadership, people in the positions of administrative leadership, taking bolder steps than they've taken. And it's not an easy thing. I and many other people have been at this for decades, and the progress is, you know, one step forward, two steps back, two steps forward, one step back. I will say, we need more men who are in positions of institutional leadership, who are willing to identify themselves publicly with this set of issues. And I think what we've had is some incredible women and a handful of men.
We're talking with Jackson Katz right now. He's an educator, author, and social theorist who focuses on gender, race, and violence. He'll be speaking at UW-Eau Claire this evening. And Jackson, Wisconsin's National Guard Adjutant General was recently removed from his post because it came out that he intentionally ignored the protocols in place on how to address multiple complaints of sexual assault and harassment. You consult with the military frequently. How challenging is it to make change in those organizations and in that culture?
I think it's complicated. It's both easy and hard. In an authoritarian and a hierarchically organized institution like the United States military or any military, if you get buy-in from leadership at all levels of command, if you get buy-in, you can make changes much more quickly. If you don't have buy-in, then it's much more difficult. Even with the buy-in, I don't mean to minimize the challenges, because you're trying to change institutional culture. And some of the best thinking, I think, in the field at this moment, if you will, in 2020, in the field of domestic and sexual violence prevention, is that you have to change culture and environments locally and, you know, and in a broad sense. And to me, one of the most obvious ways of changing culture, changing the local environment or the broader environment, is through leadership. And if you have good, strong leadership, you can change those cultural environments. You can make it clear that abusive behavior, harassing behavior is completely unacceptable and contrary to the group's values, and there'll be consequences if you harm another person, or if you, you know, if along a continuum, not just if you're physically or sexually abusive, but if you're engaging in behavior or even talk that helps to diminish others and contribute to a culture that minimizes sexual assault and domestic violence and such. I would say over time, the military is addressing these issues. It's imperfect, and it's a huge institution with deep, you know, sort of traditions. And I think some of the shift that's happening is really happening, but it's not happening fast enough for a lot of people who work in this area. It's not happening fast enough.
And briefly, Jackson, there's been some criticism of and concern that the Me Too movement has resulted in men being afraid to even talk to female coworkers, that their honest intentions can be taken as unwanted advances. Do you see that as a problem, and how do you respond to that?
Yes, I've definitely been working on the issues of men's response to Me Too for the, you know, since Me Too really broke in 2017. And I do appreciate that a lot of men are very unsure of themselves, and they're very unsure of what the new norms are, and what are the expectations, and what does accountability look like and mean. I think there is a period of time, and it's, you know, it's not talking about 1 or 2 years. I think this is a much longer shift that's happening in the culture, where new norms are being formed, if you will, and there is new accountability in ways that didn't exist before. And But I think some men are wildly overreacting. I do think that some men who say, I can't even talk to women, I can't even make any comments, I think that's wildly overstated. But it shows you how badly we've been doing in helping boys and men, and I'm talking about crossing class and race and ethnicity and age, how badly we've been doing in socializing boys and men to work with and interact with their female peers in ways that are healthy and normal and not crossing those lines on a regular basis.
Well, Jackson, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks very much for having me.
Jackson Katz is an educator, author, and social theorist who focuses on gender, race, and violence. We talked to him about his presentation on gender violence at UW-Eau Claire. That's this evening. It begins at 7:30 in the Schofield Auditorium. You can get more info at uwec.edu. Coming up, we'll take a look at how President Trump is handling the COVID-19 threat and the economic consequences. That's up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, many different groups of immigrants have made Wisconsin their home in the last 200 years or so. One thing they have in common is the backlash they've gotten when they arrived. We'll look back at how anti-immigrant rhetoric in the state has looked over time. Now, President Trump is pitching an economic stimulus package for businesses and workers who have been hurt by COVID-19. At a news conference yesterday, he said the aid could include a payroll tax cut and help for hourly wage earners so that they don't miss a paycheck.
I'm going to be working with companies and small companies, large companies, a lot of companies, so that they don't get penalized for something that's not their fault. It's not their fault. It's not our country's fault. This was something that we were thrown into, and we're going to handle it, and we have been handling it very well.
The comments came after the Dow Jones dropped more than 2,000 points, its worst day since 2008. It went up more than 1,100 today. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said the market drop showed that investors lacked confidence in the White House's handling of the situation. At least 800 people have tested positive for COVID-19 in 36 states. Wisconsin confirmed its third case today. We'll talk more about that in our next hour. Eric Giordano is an associate professor of political science for the UW Colleges and director of the Wisconsin Institute for Public Policy and Service. He joins me now in our Wausau studio. Eric, good to have you back on the show.
Great to be here, Rob. Thank you.
The president met with Senate and House leaders today to start talking about financial relief for people affected by COVID-19. Let's talk not about the disease side of things, but that the economy side and economic confidence. What are you seeing from the president here?
Well, he obviously, you know, it's got to be distressed by the economic situation. This is really putting a huge damper on not only the economy but on perhaps his own vision of what the economy should and could be. So obviously he wants to do what he can to rebuild confidence in the economy. So that's why he's on the Hill or speaking with people on the Hill to try to restore that.
There's been an argument. Are we trying to deal with the spread of the disease first and foremost, and that's going to restore the economic confidence? Or are we at a point where the economic part of this has taken on a life of its own? What's your read on that?
Well, you know, critics have said from the beginning that we were unprepared, partly exacerbated by some defunding of the CDC and other health institutes and services in our country. So I think there was a feeling and a sense by many ready to pounce on being critical. I don't think the president's early responses taking the coronavirus perhaps as seriously as maybe some of the health experts were also really, I think, hurt him to some extent and maybe also led to some lack of confidence. He isn't going to change who he is, and he cares deeply about the economy. That is clear, and he wants to make sure that we know that he cares and that he will do his best to restore confidence in the economy. So that is his priority, whether we like it or not.
On the Senate floor today, Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said the best way to ensure economic security is to deal with the virus itself. Here's a listen.
To borrow an expression, you must treat the disease, not the symptoms. Mr. President, do you hear that? You must treat the disease, the coronavirus, not the symptoms, which is the result of the coronavirus, which is the economy.
Is that fair? I mean, some of this is the economy itself too, and there's some overlap there, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, it's got to be both and. I mean, clearly we and the American public, we want to have confidence that the virus is being addressed, and we know that we've been lacking in test kits. We know that, you know, there are many cities across the country that have don't have the ability to handle this. So people want to have that confidence, and that, of course, is going to affect, you know, their willingness to hold events, to allow transportation, to have the normal business daily business life, and so it ultimately does impact the economy, right? Our ability to address effectively in the minds of the American people that we are having effective preventive measures.
Talking to Eric Giordano with the Wisconsin Institute for Public Policy and Service, looking at the White House response to the novel coronavirus and the economic impact of that. Eric, on the level of leadership in a time of a, you know, kind of a undefined crisis, we have a disease here that's clearly not apocalyptic, but it's also not nothing. Can you talk about the challenges of hitting the right tone, not inflating panic unnecessarily while still, you know, taking a problem seriously.
Yeah, this is no easy way to thread the needle on a crisis, right? I mean, nobody wishes to be in that situation. We've seen it, you know, the criticism of George Bush and how he reacted to 9/11, the criticism of Barack Obama and how he reacted with the Gulf oil spill. And, you know, probably no president is going to react perfectly the way every American thinks that he or she should react. You know, the question is, did, you know, he do what he needed to do? Is he doing what he needs to do? I think part of the issue was the delay in taking this seriously and sort of defying even some health experts by saying this was going to peter out, that it really wasn't that big of a deal. And I think that was probably not the right tone to set at the beginning of the crisis. So I think that caused some people to lose some confidence. And of course, it allowed the critics to pile on. So, you know, it's really been a difficult start. And the question is more important to us is how will he finish and how will we finish?
Now, on the politicization of this, we heard Nancy Pelosi accusing the president of mishandling it. We actually heard the voice of Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer as well. Yesterday morning, President Trump tweeted, "The fake news media and their partner, the Democrat Party, is doing everything within its semi-considerable power to inflame the coronavirus situation far beyond what the facts would warrant." What do you make of that tone on the Twitter side of President Trump?
Well, unfortunately, it's not unexpected, and I really think that we have to take, you know, the words of Chuck Schumer that you played earlier, that, you know, we're talking about symptoms here of an incredible divide in our country, a political divide. We know that the parties are at the head, the leadership of that divide. So it's not necessarily unexpected that we have it, but it is unfortunate. And, you know, I think personally, I wish that we would all just kind of take a step back and say, look, if there's one time that we ought to be coming together, it's around a crisis. That said, you know, we do want our leader to reflect, you know, the best interests of the country. So it's not that, you know, criticism can't be leveled. It's that, you know, perhaps we should figure out how we're going to solve this problem and focus our energy on that. And I would include the media in really helping us to do that.
How could the media help us do that better? Because that's a thing I think about a lot.
Well, you know, I've watched some television news and on many different channels in the last few days, and what I see is a little less reporting on the facts and a lot of talking heads. And I think this is a symptom of really our media today in America. We know this, so it's not a secret. It's not a surprise. But, you know, there's a lot of people speculating, a lot of people giving opinions that aren't health experts, a lot of people giving political criticism, and, you know, maybe a little less focus on that and a little more focus on reporting what's happening. For example, I was listening to the BBC talking about what were some of the lessons we've learned from how the countries like South Korea versus Iran versus, you know, China have responded to this and what can we learn from that. I mean, that to me is a constructive conversation.
And we'll be talking to a Wisconsin public health expert in our next hour. So we'll try to dig into some of those issues as well. But Eric, have we lost the capacity to rally together, Republican and Democrat, to take a problem like this head on and not worry, especially in an election year, about who gets credit, who gets blame?
I said this before, Rob. I usually tell my students to remain skeptical, not cynical. But it is really hard not to be cynical about this because it seems like every time something comes up, you know, we immediately get the sides, you know, taking positions, and it would just be nice if we could decide that we're going to work on this head on. But we also have to be honest and transparent in our decision making. So if there isn't that happening at the highest levels, then, you know, it's not that we should need to sit around and pretend that that's not happening. And so we do need to be honest about this, but we also need to try to come together.
In our last few moments, Eric, what are you watching for next when it comes to economic policy over the next week or so?
Well, it'll be interesting to see if the House and Senate come together to pass any sort of relief legislation. I know it's interesting to see how the Democrats are really focused on the types of things that will get the foot in the door of helping workers long term that won't also have to take away from other programs. So, for example, they want to do workers' compensation or paid time off, even on a temporary basis, whereas President Trump is talking about payroll taxes, in which case we'd have to take away from something else. So it's an interesting philosophical debate, and interesting to see if anything happens there.
Eric, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Eric Giordano, Associate Professor of Political Science for the UW Colleges. He's also Director of the Wisconsin Institute for Public Policy and Service. We talked to him about the Trump administration's approach to the COVID-19 outbreak. We'll have more on the public health aspect coming up. This is a special edition of Central Time because I'm hosting from our studio in Wausau. We're on the UW-Stevens Point at Wausau campus. I'm moderating an event tonight on immigration in central Wisconsin. That's tonight at 7 at the UW Center for Civic Engagement in Wausau. I held Eric Giordano with the Wisconsin Institute for Public Policy and Service, not UW Colleges, by the way, I had that wrong, in the studio. Eric, tell us a little bit about this event series that we're part of tonight.
Right. This is a three-part series, and we're so grateful for our sponsors, including the Wisconsin Humanities Council and many others. But basically, we're trying to look at what are some of the myths, common myths around immigration, both legal and illegal. What do we know? What don't we know? So our first event was a month ago. We brought in a national speaker and a state-level speaker, one of which you're having on your next segment, mm-hmm. Dr. Barker. And then tonight we're doing what's called a Fred-friendly seminar, which is a seminar based on a series back in the 1980s and 90s on PBS where a moderator would host about a dozen people on a panel-like setting and ask questions around a key topic. In this case, we're talking about immigration in central Wisconsin. How does it affect the sheriff's department? How does it affect farmers? How does it affect real people on the ground?
That's coming up tonight in Wausau at 7. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.